How could you not want to read a book with chapter headings like Lucifer's Childhood, 1971 to 76, The Armored Dildo, and Danger Quentin, There's a Dog Behind You? The front cover of Paul Simpson's book, Revolutionary Spirit, A Post-Punk Exorcism, features a very handsome young man in his early 20s glancing to the side. An 80s flaneur, if ever there was one, according to a mate of mine. The book itself is one of the most revealing and funniest I've read in years. The bump on the inside front jacket describes it as part memoir, part social history, and that's about right. It describes Paul's life before, during, and after the Wild Swans, and focuses on the music scene in Liverpool in the late 70s and early 80s, which was the first musical explosion in the city since the Merseybeat days. Welcome to Misadventures in Music with me, Nick Ord.
And me, Ian Prowse, from a very rainy Liverpool today.
And our guest, Paul Simpson. Well done, Paul. Cracking book. And you're now based in Glasgow, aren't you?
Hiya, fellas. Thank you very much. I'm up in Glasgow now. Been here for nearly 2 years. Missing Liverpool horribly, but I haven't talked about it that much. But I was feeling a little bit, nothing had been happening for me for a long time. Have you ever had a pot plant and you walk past it every day for years and you keep thinking, I really must repot that, at some point. And then eventually, when you do after 10 years, and you ease it out of the pot and there's no soil at all, it's just a root ball. And I was a root ball.
What made you move from a rainy Liverpool to an even rainier place?
I've got to take vitamin D tablets up here, seriously, because there's no sunlight ever. Why do we do anything? I was following a woman, wasn't I? I was following my partner, Jamie,
Oh, we've all been there.
job up here. And I didn't take the decision lightly. I really had to think about it because my son's down in Liverpool. And, but as I say, nothing had been happening. I had a lot of stalled projects, financial problems, and stuff. And madly, like when you change the soil in a pot plant, the minute I moved, the energy changed and good stuff started happening. I fell in with some, there's a quite a healthy little underground scene up here. I just all sort of organically found them and got embedded in. A lot of projects that stalled for financial reasons 10 years ago, I just started getting phone calls, go, oh, that money's in place now if you still want to do that project, Paul. And record companies get in touch. I'd quite like to do a record with you. Paul, have you got anything you'd like, you've unreleased? And amazing, absolutely amazing.
We had
So,
Paul Denoyer on last,
oh yeah.
and it's that thing of being outside the city makes you look at it clearer, doesn't it?
Oh yeah,
Like
absolutely.
yourself, I'm not, even though I've lived in the town, in the city centre for 18 years, I'm from across the river, so I always had one foot in and one foot out. Like,
Yeah.
because did you come from Ormskirk or?
Well, no, I was born in Huyton actually, but we moved when I was a kid. We moved when I was three up into, I mean, my dad was in the Merchant Navy, so he was never home anyway. But he just want he'd grown up in an orphanage. He didn't really have a childhood at all. He had a miserable childhood if he had one at all. So he just wanted a better chance, than this terraced house in Huyton. And so we moved to the sort of green belt, and it was literally a housing estate under construction. We were always the second family there. So it was, it was clean air and all that, but not great really for kids, because there was, the only friends I had was just the other few kids as they moved into the estate. If I was lucky enough, some might be my age. I am a bit of a, I suppose I am a bit of a woolly back, but I was, I moved out. I moved into Liverpool. I turned 18.
Being half in and half out, I think, is really good for creativity. Because now you've gone to Glasgow, it's invigorated you, hasn't it? In a bizarre
And I might be off to Dublin next as well, because I'm not sure how long we're going to be here. But Celtic power cities are all good.
You're not moving from the Celtic fringe at all, are you?
No. It's funny. Me. The Simpsons were from the Black Isle in Scotland, and my mum's side were from Ireland anyway. So I've not. It's not really that big a deal that I'm here, you know, or maybe in Dublin. It's sort of, you know, you always go home in the end, don't you?
Yeah.
Your DNA kind of thing. But anyway, so moving was traumatic, but kind of exciting as well. You know, I see it in my book. The book ends with me moving here, and the car was all packed, the house was all locked up, been sold. And I got me 20 year old Nissan Micra to drive up, and the car wouldn't start, so we had to decamp.
Don't leave.
We literally jumped on a train with one suitcase apiece, and I said, say in the book, we felt like teenagers running away from home, and it was. Yeah. And then when we arrived, it was snowing, and we'd got this rented flat in Hillhead, which was on, you know, in tenements here, so it was looking down. Woke up the next morning and there's baby foxes playing beneath our window in the snow, and I just thought, oh my God, this is magical. Yeah.
Well, Glasgow's a complete vibe as well, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Really. I mean, I'm going up there and playing for 35 years myself now. In fact, in the next month, I've got to go and play three different times, all in Glasgow. And so I'm in and out of it all the time. So I watched it change so much.
Yeah.
But it's as good as it's ever been right now, I think.
For me, really healthy music scene going on, and I've actually got myself a thing going with Last Night from Glasgow, who are one of they're almost the country's biggest indie record label now, and it's a one man.
Yeah, they've just done the Blue Monkeys album, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I went to their shop.
Madly, they've got it's a Materials and China Crisis, putting all the China Crisis stuff out now. So they're called Last Night from Glasgow, but when they do re-releases, it's called Past Night from Glasgow. I'm just trying to think of some clever Scouse version for what could it be? Scouse Night from Glasgow.
I went to their little shop in the West.
Oh, yeah, in Hidden Lane, yeah.
Yeah, I was doing a gig with the Blow Monkeys only about 6 weeks ago. They did a little gig in the shop, and it was great.
Oh, okay. We should have known about that.
I met them all there, you know. So it's that's part of the thing that's going on in Glasgow at the moment, isn't it? So it's great that you've kind of hooked into that.
Well, I went in and introduced myself to Ian. I felt a bit of a trap, but I went in and went, my name's Paul Simpson. I've just moved here from the Wild Swans. Nothing. I went, actually, I was founder member of the Teardrop Explosion. Nothing. I used to be in a band with Ian Brody, you know, from the Lightning Seed. Nothing like that. And then he just sort of looked up from his computer and went, I knew who you were when you walked in. I was like, he was fucking with me. And anyway, he's very sweet. And so I've been talking to him about the possibilities, possibly releasing some old stuff, maybe some new stuff.
Yeah.
But it's all lovely. And I've, you know, and through them, I've met Bobby Bluebell, who's just hilarious. So me and him are pub buddies. And Chris Thompson from The Bathers, Graham Skinner, a lot of the old.
Yeah.
Can we swear on this? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, is that right? Okay. A lot of us old fuckers. Yeah. So I've got pub mates, which is great, you know.
That's what else do you need, you know, an outlet for your creativity and some people to go to the pub with. That's everything ticked off, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and well, my first night at the pub here, it is, you know, they say Glasgow and Liverpool are very similar. They are, but they're not as well. My experience of Glaswegians is they're very friendly, but you have to kind of make the effort first move kind of thing. And then once they know you're okay, they're great. So I was in the Bell on the Great Western Road. And you know what Scouse is like? So we walk into a room of party and you don't even say hello, you just go, fucking hell, you'll never guess what just happened to me. that because you know, because something did just happen to you, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And then there was a whole table of Scousers that lived there. So I've got a whole, I've got a little Scouse group of friends here as well.
Yeah.
I see. And yeah, it's good. All good.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Paul, you're very honest in the book. You mentioned your dad before.
Mm.
And I mean, as I said in the intro, you know, I was laughing out loud at some of the, and we'll have to tell Ian a bit later about the exorcism. I've read that thing this morning. You'll pee yourself laughing. But getting the serious tone of voice on, you're very honest about your dad and the kind of difficult relationship you had with him a little bit. And I'm glad you mentioned the fact he had quite a difficult childhood himself, because that kind of communication thing between you and him really didn't work out a lot of the time. And you go into some detail about that. Was that quite difficult to do?
Yeah, well, I thought if I'm going to do this, I've waited so long to tell my story, I may as well be honest about it. Honest with myself, you know. Well, I'll let me answer your question first. So a lot of people my age had difficulty with their fathers because they'd been in the war. My dad served because he went from the orphanage into the Merchant Navy at 14. So he was already at sea when war broke out. He was very young, but he was. And like a lot of my friends' dads, they wouldn't talk about it. They just would not talk about it afterwards. So I tell the story that my mum used to, who was his polar opposite. She was an artist, a real free spirit, you know. Would ask him, well, how did you feel in the orphanage? And he'd say, well, what do you mean, how did I feel? You know, I just got on with it. That's the most you'd get out with him. The only time he talked about the war was when we had visitors to the house. A stranger was there. He'd come out with these amazing stories, incredible stories that informed me a bit as to why he was so hard with me. You know, because he was a real disciplinarian and he couldn't bear me not respecting his wishes, you know, because I took after my mum. She was my pole star, really. So it was a very polarized childhood. I had a horrible thing, a working class conservative voting father and a working class Labour voting, lifelong Labour voting free spirit. Very weird how they got together. I don't know. So it's not surprising. I'm a bit mad, like, but well, these stories had come out with about kind of like he was in Shanghai 2 hours before the invasion, and you know his best friend fell off an observation platform and smashed his head on and was killed outright, and he had to put his body in the ship's freezer, and he was in a two-ship convoy, and he had a locomotive train chained to the deck. It was in Lagos or somewhere. And the chain started working loose when they were a few miles out. So we had to return to port to get it secured. The other boat, 10 minutes later, the other boat was torpedoed by a U-boat, all lives lost. So all these mad stories coming out, but only never to us, only to strangers. So I don't know what that was all about. But yeah, I had a very difficult relationship with him. I mean, I loved him and I know he loved us. He just couldn't, he was never shown love.
Was it cathartic to write it all down though?
Massively. And God, I highly recommend anyone to do it, even if it doesn't get published, because I don't know what I think about things till I write them down. But looking at my own actions after 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, things I used to blame other people for, I now realize why they did those things, because I wasn't very good at communicating. Well, I suppose like my dad, it wasn't.
Yeah.
We didn't, you know, we always like, when we were all growing up, we didn't hug our mates and things like we do now and young people do now. We wouldn't dream of telling anyone we love them, would we, and stuff. But
do it all the time now.
Yeah, we do it all the time now, don't we? And the exorcism in the book subtitle, The Exorcism, to be honest with you, I just thought that was a good subtitle at first. And there was, you know, there's a story about me going to see the exorcist when I was too young on my own and not being able to sleep for 2 years and stuff like that. But it's nothing to do with that. The exorcism's about my dad. It's about my relationships with my partners, my writing partners, and it's now the perfect title for it because it's been an exorcism.
Like listening back to that, Paul, now, because I remember when that came out, it was in the indie charts and everything. And what's it like? I know you've probably heard it millions of times, like, but
well, actually, no, because I couldn't listen to it for a long, you know. One of we were talking about the book subtitle, A Post-Punk Exorcism. Part of the thing was that when the Wild Swans broke up. The Mark One Wild Swans broke up. I was devastated. I felt so betrayed, and I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't listen to it or anything. So it's only obviously I've heard it across the years, but I never listen to my own stuff. I can't stand it mostly. No, I'm not joking. I really can't. There's very little of my own work that I feel is actually.
Do you feel more at ease with it now, though, as you've gotten older and you
yeah.
do this book and
yeah, something weird's happened as well. You know, we really fell victim to that. We should never have split up. John Peel said that to me. Oh, you should never have split up. We should never have split up. When we reformed, we forgot to be remarkable. You know, we signed this holy grail of record deals, a 2-album fixed deal with Seymour Stein, Sire Records, and in that gap between the Wild Swans Mark One, Kerr with Ian Brody, and then we reformed Mark Two and got the Sire deal. Not only had we changed as people, but the musical climate had changed, and you know, Thatcher's reign of terror was in, and but also that there was the producer was king, the big snare drums, you know, and somehow that had, I think it was people like Green from Scritti Politti, some of those very early indie kind of heroes had embraced it. Arif Mardin Productions, big snare drums and stuff. So you've got to understand. It was like, so punk had put very tight fences around what was permissible and what wasn't. And then post-punk, each single that came out gradually sort of, you know, widened those fences again. We still weren't allowed progressive rock, noodling and all that, but the fences were getting wider and stuff. But something happened about 1985, six. It as money was with Thatcher's kind of greed thing, it almost became fashionable to let go and embrace the big shiny MTV dream. And we didn't really, we were trying not to, but we still, you know, we signed this fantastic record deal. But then the first thing Seymour Stein told us is we need to get rid of our manager, our fantastic manager, you know, you need American representation, all this kind of stuff. And very quickly, I've seen it happen to a million bands and a million Liverpool bands, is you forget your mission statement and why you started the band in the first place. Or we did in the 80s. And again, as I say in the book, even Marky Smith was wearing mascara, you know. Yeah. It was, and you know, Lou Reed was playing one of them hideous Steinberger basses, you know, headless.
People forgot it's about music.
Yeah.
It's not about money or fame women or attention. Yeah. It's about music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Keep your eye on that. You might be okay along the line.
I couldn't listen to a lot of that stuff, the Sire era at all. But something weird's happened as more times passed on, another decade's passed. Those sorts of productions with the big snare drums and the, you know, the billion quid productions, they get in a sort of patina, you know, like an antique.
Yeah.
So because they're not current anymore, they're past, and then they're now actually being referenced by younger bands. They actually think that's a cool end of the 80s, which is weird.
But it must have been amazing to get, you know how hard it is to get record deals. And that, you know, it's when you're a kid, it's just the one thing you want is to be signed to a big label. So
yeah,
when
but
you must have been over the moon.
Well, we were, but to be honest, because of my, you know, from Eric's, I met Julian, met Mac, Will Sargent, you know, and we Bill Drummond, we'd only existed a couple of weeks, and Bill Drummond offered to put a single out. That single got single of the week in both music papers. Then I left the Teardrops, formed the Wild Swans. Got a single out very quickly. That got single of the week in both music papers. Then, you know, we split up. Then me and Ian Brody just did some demos together. Got offered. It's always come very easily. So I didn't have to actually have that struggle. I did later on. I just think it was the time. You know, Liverpool was totally under the microscope for a while when the Teardrops had a hit and the Bunnymen. All, you know, Pale Fountains, everyone got signed very quickly. And then, and then, yeah. and
than the same. I remember Pete Wiley being on the front of NME before they had any music out.
Yeah, they sent journalists and A&R guys down to Eric's, you know, and it didn't last long, but it wasn't that difficult for a while because I'm not that much older than you, Ian. I know that how hard it was later on, you know, when the circus left town, went to Manchester and stuff. You know.
Yeah, but for us, you know, we were like the next generation along. We felt as if it was absolutely fantastic that Liverpool had, again, after Merseybeat, it wasn't dead in the water. There was this entire scene of brilliant bands, you know, based around a club. And it felt as though, right, that was it. Liverpool was always going to be a special place to be from, which was facilitated by what you guys had done almost, you know, the advanced party ahead of us had gone, no, Liverpool is special. And it was kind of that scene that you're involved in, you know, with the Bunny Men, and then later Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Ian Brody and all that. It kind of rubber stamped the city in a way that the first time wasn't just luck, that it's in the DNA and it will always come round, you know.
Yeah.
And that was, for our generation, we owed your lot that, I think, you know. Well, listen to that song there now, it's still, you know, if you listen to the music from that era, you know, 80, 81, 82, it still sounds fucking fantastic to me, you know. I just immediately access me being a really young boy and hearing it and go, wow, what's going on, you know?
Yeah, I'm incredibly proud of Revolutionary Spirit and the kind of Peel and Jensen sessions we did in the Mark One band. And I've never really got back there. I was saying earlier, I don't really like a lot of my recorded stuff because I just felt like we kind of weirdly nailed it when we were 21, you know. Yeah. We never saw any rewards from it or anything, but it kind of...
Yeah, but the guy in Glasgow recognised you, so, you know.
True. Yeah.
But more than just Liverpool.
It's lovely having a cult sort of single. It's almost better than having a chart hit or something, you know. Yeah. It was re-released 16 months ago and actually went to number one in the indie charts. I should have made, you know, again, the 7-inch re-release. So that was nice, you know.
When I asked you to send us some songs to put on the playlist.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I don't know any of them.
No, do you know what? Well, there's two things. I'd done a podcast that hasn't gone out yet of us, and they'd sort of asked me for a sort of my top 10. So I didn't want to repeat it, and also like I thought it wouldn't be fair on the other, but also I've written in my book about I get a bit frustrated with how the music press and us guys ourselves, we keep banging on about the same 100 albums, which is, and they're deservedly brilliant, you know. It's, you know, obviously the Stooges and the Beach Boys and Miles Davis and dinner, but it's all a kind of perceived Western good taste. And I listen to classical music and always have, and listen to all kinds of music, and I just get a bit frustrated sometimes that, you know, with the same things being celebrated, because we know, you know, there's a bit of a rant in the book, isn't there? Mick, there's a sort of rant in there about...
It's the same thing with, like, Mojo magazine. It's the same 10 people on it. The front goes around in a big circle, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I just thought, if I've got the opportunity to turn people onto some other stuff...
Yeah.
And to be honest, I didn't want to get too beard-strokey about it either. So I just put some stuff together that I thought would be...
No, it was amazing. It was amazing. And I was thinking, my God, this track by... who was it? Sorry, I've...
Get it on me.
Harvest Time it was. It was just over 20 minutes. So what I've done is... The first one we're going to play is by my Dutch pronunciation isn't that good. De Evergreens.
Yeah, they were actually called The Evergreens, but on the label it was printed as De Evergreens. So I think they had to change the name to De Evergreens. It's a Dutch Indonesian thing, yeah. And I only discovered it recently, actually. But I couldn't stop playing it. It's so infectious.
Oh, it's lovely. It. Yeah. I thought it was a Scouse band, De Evergreens, and I thought I've never heard of them. That can't be right. Anyway, we'll play that now. It's called S Lillin,
which is ice lolly translation.
Space robbed female of the species from.
Oh yeah, it does sound like I've clocked that before. Yeah,
the track I was talking about before that we're going to put on your suggested playlist, Paul, is Harvest Time by Pharoah Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
20 minutes 24 seconds. All right, Ian.
I love it when you get something new, you know, and you just go. Yeah. I've just got to open my mind to this, and if it connects with you, it connects with you. It's lovely.
I've been trying to get hold of this on vinyl for years, and it's just been re-released, but it's £50.
Oh Jesus!
It's a beautiful piece of music, you know. I think
when you did the original Wild Swans, and then you moved on to do the thing with Ian Brodie, and it was the great. You know, Flaming Sword was a classic single, wasn't it? What the hell happened there? Why did you walk away from that when it was looking as though it was going to be, you know?
Well, I did walk away. We had a hit, you know, we had a top 50, kind of 48 or something. Well, the thing is, see, Ian and I never intended to work together. The Wild Swans, Mark One had sort of burst into flames. And I was doing some solo demos. So I lived on Hope Street at the time. And so I play guitar and I sing, but I don't sing or play guitar very well at all. One, you know, they both suffer, sort of thing. So I'd written this sort of intricate guitar part that I could sort of do okay on a pause studio sort of thing. But cut long story short, I couldn't play it well enough. So Will Sargent had moved in round the corner on the avenue. So I bombed round to his and asked him to play it. And he couldn't play it either. Because Will's a great guitarist, but he's a type of guitarist. This was way too sort of fancy, really. So he said, "Well, I can't play, but I'll give Ian a knock." And I said, "Who's Ian?" He said, "Ian Brody." And I knew Ian from Eric's, but we weren't mates or anything. And so Ian came in, and he knocked off in 2 seconds on my Porter studio. Because I was intending to sort of pursue, we were sort of being sniffed around by Arista Records, so I was going to do these demos and take them to Arista Records. So before I left, Ian said, "Well, listen, can you do me a favor? I've written this song. Could you sing it for me?" So he gave me this cassette. So I took it home and I listened to it. And I thought, well, it was called Tall Ships. I couldn't sing it. I don't know why I can't. It's like why I've never done a cover version. I can't sing other people's melodies and words. I just find it impossible to know how to voice it, you know. So I went back and I said, "I can't, Ian." I said, "The only thing I could do is write my own melody to it." And he said, "Okay, then." So I did that. I thought, well, that's weird. All right. So I banged some words down, gave it him back. Like 4 days later, Bill Drummond's knocking on my door saying, "All right, Paul, I've got you a record deal." I went, "What? Fucking hell, Bill, brilliant. Yeah, yeah, great." And he went, no, don't get it. Not just you and Ian Brody. I was like, "Well, but me and Ian Brody aren't a thing." And he said, "Well,
really? Was that weird?"
Yeah. Yeah, it's very weird. It was really random. But my mental health wasn't great at the time. I was really feeling destroyed by my bandmates. I thought they'd be sort of done me over. It's all. I won't go into that all now. But that's part of the exorcism in the book title as well.
Came completely out the blue then.
Yeah, and it was a big deal with quite a lot of money.
Right.
You know? And I'm on my 23 quid a week, you know, on the dole. And I just thought, well, let's see how it goes, you know. And me and Ian liked each other and we got on. And so we did three singles. And then we were in the middle of doing an album. And Ian and I were a bit like, who's a bit chalk meat cheese in a way. We got on, but Ian's a night bird,
yeah,
and a morning person. Yeah. So we hired this little room at the back of St. Luke's Church, and put a little eight track studio in there with a Fostex, a little mixing desk, because we had the advance to do it with.
Yeah,
but we were never in there together. So I'd let myself in at 9 o'clock in the morning and work till 5, and Ian would rock up at 6 and work till 1 in the morning. So anyway,
but the whole thing was accidental in the first place.
It was sort of accidental, yeah. It was. I was still haunted by the Wild Swans, you see.
Right.
Kept comparing it to the Wild Swans. You know, I now know what I didn't know at the time was that I was suffering from severe depression. You know, I just didn't know. You know, we never went to the doctors with that stuff in those days. There was no sort of terminology. No. I used to self-harm when I was a kid, and I didn't know that was a thing. I thought it was my thing. I didn't know it was a thing with a name. Anyway, so we're in Rack in London, and we've got the backing tracks of an album down. I've put guide vocals down. We've got these monitor mixes done, and then I just could have said, "I can't do this anymore. My heart's not in it. I can't promote a record I don't believe in."
And yeah.
So I was really cowardly move. I kind of just walked out on it. I just walked out on the project. I didn't really discuss it with him. I just wrote him a letter saying, "I can't do it, Ian." And so that was awful. Yeah. And I felt guilty about that for 35 years. And it was only 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I bumped into Ian in the street in Liverpool. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I was just out for coffee." He said, "Come with me. Do you want to come with me?" So we went back to, he had this rehearsal. It was the 30th, he was doing this Jollification 30th anniversary tour rehearsals. So I just went and hung out with him at their rehearsals. And oh God, it's fucking hilarious. I just remember as we were, while Ian was out, a giant strawberry had been delivered, you know, to be winched above the stage. But there was some sort of spinal tap metric miscalculation had gone on because it was huge. It was like in a hot air balloon size. There was hardly any room for Ian to get under it. So we just couldn't stop laughing, the two of us, at this ridiculous situation. And then Ian just really sort of winded me with this. He just said, "What are you doing on Saturday?" I said, "Nothing. Why?" And he said, "Because we're playing, the Lightning Seeds are playing at the Phil. Do you want to come and sing Flaming Sword on stage with me?" Well, we'd never played live.
Right.
And I was so, I'd been carrying this guilt with me for 35 years. And Ian was just lovely. And the fact that he asked me to do that, I was like really
kind of,
yeah, I was really moved. Oh, I was brilliant. I was a bit crap because
yeah, it doesn't matter.
we just had run through on acoustic guitar in the green room in the afternoon.
That must have been a really lovely experience for you, because if you hadn't met him for so long and all of a sudden you bump into him in the street and he's really sweet about it and even invites you on.
He didn't need to be. So I read Ian's book recently and I texted him and said, "Wow, I've just read the Kerr stuff, you know, and thank you for being so nice about me, you know." Yeah.
And he is a lovely sweetheart. He was.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it because
I got COVID early on when it first really came out, and he was constantly messaging. Are you okay? You know, to my.
I wasn't expecting him to be so nice about me in the book because I didn't deserve it, and then I knew he'd be worried about mine.
Yeah.
And when I'd wrote my Kerr chapter, I just kept it funny, really, about how hilarious it was to test, because we got quite a lot of money, you know. Yeah. So we turned up at Air Studios on Oxford Street, George Martin's studios.
Yeah.
And there's flight cases all down one wall with Paul McCartney. Flight cases the other side with Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, because he's in there doing Pipes of Peace album. And we get out of a taxi and I've got an entry-level pair of bongos and Ian's got an acoustic guitar he hasn't even got a case for it. We're walking into Air Studios with Macca and Jacko and Stevie Wonder.
I have an empathy with him as well, because he's the only other Liverpool music scene Ian that isn't fucking mad. I'll leave that there.
That seems like a good time to play your next choice here, Paul. It's James and Bobby Purify, "Let Love Come Between Us."
We have to say, we can stop all this fuss.
back to the soul music in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I had an older sister, and because we were out Ormskirk way, she was into my Northern Soul and stuff, and it's the music I always go back to.
In every podcast, you know, Paul, it always some way finds its way back to soul music. Yeah, I don't know what it is, does it? Isn't it, Mick?
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah.
And I love that you've put this one in because it's just...
Oh, it's so uplifting and beautiful.
It's emotional, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes me back to my source kind of thing, you know. There's a track I've written about in my book. It's a late period Marvin Gaye track that it was only released posthumously, called Life's Opera. And again, it's about 16 minutes long. And it's very Marvin. So he's singing about God and spirituality, but he's also singing about me and you need to be getting it on. And, you know, it's both his
obsessions.
It's like sort of, God and the devil either side of him, but it's a fantastic track. And as I say, it even survives. It's got a horrible keyboard bass someone's put on it, but it's such a beautiful song. But yeah, it's just soul does what it says on the tin, doesn't it?
Paul, you're mentioned there of the devil. Will you please tell us the exorcism story? I've read it about four times. I was just in bulk. He makes a schoolboy error that he'll reveal at the end of the story.
I mentioned earlier about my mum being this sort of new age sort of artist, painter, free spirit. In fact, she's the only woman in the cemetery it just says Doris Simpson, free spirit. Not even dates. That's her greatest.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she didn't want. She was so vain. She didn't want the neighbors to know how old she was. There's no one left. I love that free spirit. So even in the late 50s and early 60s, she was into like an early New Ager before it was a thing. So she used to buy all these Victorian sort of spiritualist books, Annie Besant and stuff. She had this little library at home, and as I was growing up, she just used to read me odd bits and pieces. So and I went to a church school because it was the only school out in Ormskirk where, you know, in this green belt, it was a 200-year-old church school. So it was proper Bible bashing stuff. So I was getting that in one ear, again, this polarization. Mum was telling me all this other stuff in the other ear. So I grew up believing in the concept of spirit. So spirituality, not religion kind of thing. Good and bad to that is I was incredibly open-minded to the idea of ghosts and things. And and then I went to see The Exorcist tonight like an idiot because I was expecting it to be like Hammer House, a horror type stuff. And I wasn't expecting, you know, Babylonian.
You were having nightmares, weren't you? Or dreams about...
I still do, constantly.
I think a whole generation was traumatised by the film.
Yeah, well, this notion of possession, I'd never heard of it before I went to see that film. And then I was convinced, you know. But also, that was informed by my mum telling me that this sort of thing was sort of kind of possible. So I was plagued by them, and at one point I just wasn't sleeping anymore because I was so disturbed by my dreams. They always take the same form. Some sort of demon appears. I'm in an empty building. It's dark, and something sort of manifests before me, and I always think I can handle it and try and subdue it, and I do. Partially, and then right at last minute, it kind of devours me, and I wake up kind of, you know, wet sheet stuff. And anyway, it got to the point where I was genuinely starting to lose my mind over it, and I thought, I've got to do something about it. So I I arranged to see a vicar about it, and that's harder than you would think. It's really hard. You have to go through mad vetting process. And this is Protestant. This isn't like Catholics. I say I should have gone to the Catholics that have like welcomed me in here. But to cut a long story short, so I managed to get an appointment. So I turned up at this church that shall not be named in the countryside. And And the church was all locked up, but I had this arrangement and what's going on. And eventually this old dear appeared and says, oh, over in the church hall. And I was like, oh, that's no good, because I want the full fiery cross stuff, you know. So I was shown through to this little back room, and it was just full of stacked chairs and things. And I was really disappointed. I thought, I can't cast demons out in here, you know, there's no room. anyway, so this vicar comes in. And nameless vicar comes in, and he wouldn't look at me. He wouldn't catch my eye. He wouldn't shake my hand. And it was really weird. And because he wasn't talking, I just kept babbling and babbling and babbling. It was getting worse and worse. And you need to read the story really in the book for me to do it justice. So he says he knew why I was there, because he'd been told why I was there, but he pretended he hadn't. He was acting really weird. He just wouldn't look at me as a man. He thought a demon was going to jump out or something. I told him my most recent dream, and it wasn't really typical, but it was about this sort of, this harpy. I was at the crossroads, you know, like Robert Johnson sort of crossroads, and this harpy appears, and she's sort of half beautiful woman and half kestrel. And I try and subdue her, and she sort of devours me kind of thing, but... It says nothing. And I'm like, even if you think I'm mad, even if you think I'm some baghead wandering off the street, that's the best bit of drama you've seen all week. You've got to at least acknowledge that I'm here, you know. And then I realized when I was leaving, I wanted a blessing or something. I just wanted some sort of, or even a you know, some human warmth. It's very hard to talk about this stuff and without people thinking you're insane, you know. And but I realized beyond that the guy had no faith. He was taking the money for being the vicar in that parish, but he has absolutely no faith whatsoever. So it's actually it's a funny story, isn't it, Mick? And I've made it sound like it's not.
No, well, it was the way you described him. He put his sausage fingers on my head.
Oh yeah, I had
he
to
put
make
his fingers
it
on your head, and he started rubbing them. But there was no spiritual engagement. There was no emotional engagement,
nothing so whatsoever. I had to ask him. You know, he didn't volunteer anything. He was of no help to me whatsoever, or anyone. I thought, well, you know, I am half mad. I know that, but you know, someone suicide could have gone in there.
Well, the schoolboy error, Paul, as you admit in the book, was not going to a Catholic priest.
Yeah.
They've gone to the real one.
I was just going to say, you know, I took a real risk with some of those stories, with my own credibility, you know what I mean? But amazingly, you know, it's on its third reprint already. It only came out December the 5th. It's selling fantastically well. And I've had so many emails and messages on social media.
I don't think it goes anywhere near destroying any credibility or anything like that. Because that's kind of like, that's the old world, isn't it?
I suppose.
And the NME, and you might get on the radio. The new way in the modern world of doing this wonderful work that you're doing right now is by doing like things like this and social media, and it just being talked about in pubs. Now that the old gatekeeper thing of you've got to get past the guy at the NME or whatever,
yeah,
meaningless now. And it's been proved to working for you. It's in its third print and all that sort of stuff. It's obviously a great story. It's not ghostwritten or anything. This is just you, isn't it? Unvarnished. So I think things about credibility, fuck all that. You know, it doesn't matter, does it?
I think I just meant, I thought I might have got some sort of pushback from people going, oh, God, you don't believe in ghosts, do you? Or, you know, or bloody hell, how mad are you? Nothing, just everyone saying, what a fantastic read. I've only had really positive, broad praise for it, which I really wasn't expecting, you know.
Well, everybody's kind of complex, aren't they? And I think people recognise that it's straightforward, just all lovely, and nobody's straightforward or bad. We're a mix of all different things, aren't we? And
I read a lot of music memoir. Not because I like the music. Often I don't like the musicians, or I just think it's a really fascinating kind of, particularly the bad ones. But I read
the Phil Collins one just because. And it's really good.
Yeah, well, there you go. You know, but I think what pushed me to be a bit braver with it was I read what's his name? Joe Jackson's book.
Oh, okay.
I'm not a fan or anything, but I came across this book, and oh my God, it's so dull. There's literally a chapter about the night him and his mate go out and almost cop off with some girls. It's a whole chapter. That's the big story in there.
No, so that inspired you to just put all of the wild bits in.
Well,
what people are interested in, aren't they?
Yeah, to be honest, I've had to be a little bit sensitive. You know, I was married and stuff for a long time, and I had to be a bit sensitive about that. So I haven't really told secrets and stuff. It's just, life is mad and life is magical. And I just wanted to, I think what's working for it is I wrote it in the historical sort of present tense, which is quite rare. So yeah, the reader is always looking through my eyes. So when I'm five and I get electrocuted, put my hand in the back of the telly, you feel it, you know. And when I'm on stage for the first ever gig as a front man and someone in the front row goes, ew, he looks like he's dead. You feel the hurt I felt on stage, and you know, yeah. And it's a hard tense to write in because it denies you any reflection. So you can't, you're only ever in the present moment. You can't go, but looking back on it 30 years later, because that.
It's a good device though, isn't it?
It's very good. If you can pull it off, it's hard. It's very hard to do. Because you there's loads of tripwires that you can't.
It leaves more to the reader's imagination when you do that.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether you know. I never start a story at the beginning. I start it in the middle, and I very rarely tie stories up at the end. I leave, like, you know, there's a huge story in there about us preparing to do a gig in the Philippines, but I never actually say how the gig went. I leave it with us about to go on stage, you know, and because I just think it makes for a more exciting read, really.
If you look at the cover, it looks like, and this is not a criticism, it looks like it's going to be very serious and quite intense. And there are moments like that, but I laughed out loud loads of times, and I wasn't expecting that. And that's what you want, isn't it? You want to get surprised.
Yeah. Well, I like those sort of books, you know, but also I think people do get me wrong and always have. I used to have a reputation as being aloof, but it wasn't aloofness. It was shy. I was terribly shy. You know, I've never quite been Scouse enough. I've never, you know, because I don't do the football thing. And people, I think, certainly Liverpool used to get me wrong and thought I was a bit kind of unfriendly But it was just shyness, really, and not knowing how to fit in without the footy stuff, you know. And
right, we're going to play Yusef Lateef, Russell and Elliot now.
This is great. This is, if ever I make a movie, this is going to be the opening scene. I can't believe no one's used it.
Thank you.
all of these sound really, really interesting songs.
Yeah, I tried not to overthink it too much. I always liked that track in particular. It's so smoky, Manhole cover. It's from an album called Detroit, and it's so Detroit, isn't it? It's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And just one that doesn't get name checked very often. I'm just surprised it's not, even in jazzhead circles, it's not that well known, you know. Anyway,
I didn't know much about him. I looked him up on Wiki, and he was going till he was 93.
So oh yeah, yeah.
He was working until he was 93. He only died in 2013. 10 years.
Yeah, a lot of those guys. Who's the other guy? Dexter Gordon, you know, another saxophonist. He was going to the end, you know, just kept going.
So your career is only about what 30% of the way through. You got a long ways to go.
Yeah,
I am so unprolific. I've got more unreleased albums than released. I recorded one in just as lockdown was ending. I recorded a new Wild Swans album and I never got the vocals. It was self-financed, so when lockdown was over I couldn't afford to go back in, and then when I could afford to go back in the studio had closed and didn't know where the masters were, and oh my god, you know.
Has that been lost for all
time? No, it's savable. It's just I've enjoyed the writing so much. It's somewhere I want to move into, really. I've got a live agent I've been with for about 10 years and I've never done a gig. And he asks me every year, he asks me, and he's been back on recently going, oh, the book's doing really well. There's be a real interest in you doing a Wild Swans tour, you know. And
Did I see that you'd rewritten parts of the book? So you've been actually at it for a long time.
Yeah,
It's, as I say, it's not. It's all you've written it, haven't you? Because
I've written every word.
Those writers in, and you were dead comfortable with writing about, you know, it as a writer.
Well, I've always written unpublished. You know, I used to write bits of stories and diaries and stuff. And back in the MySpace days, I used to have to do a regular sort of blog and stuff. And a lot of it was sort of come from that. Excuse me, that blog, but I sent me best story, you know. Oh god, Matt, this is how stupid I am. I sent my best story. So my editor on this book was called Tom Seabrook. He wrote a book about David Bowie called Bowie in Berlin. And so I was sending him the book in chunks. So I sent him three stories, or thought I'd sent him three stories. And then when the book was on its kind of final, kind of this is your last chance to fix the spellings, I said, where's the story about Nico making me breakfast in Amsterdam? Where's the story about Paul McCartney pissed as a fart, you know, tapping me on the shoulder, wondering why I don't want to know who he is? I don't know. I've never read those stories. So I went into my email and I sent them to an engineer in Liverpool with a similar with a similar name. And he just my Simo sent me bad stories. He didn't think to let me know. So I'm starting a second volume because I already got these amazing stories. I didn't know the first one. And then So I'd quite like to write a bit more about now, about how I live now and where I am at now, rather than
it's a time of great flux for you, isn't it? You know, and excitement at the same time.
Yeah,
and
it's exciting.
I imagine. So it's all
very exciting,
good, isn't it?
But it's I feel quite it's quite scary as well because I don't really have I don't know where I live, you know. I don't know where I live anymore. And life as a musician, especially one that doesn't release records or play gigs, money's tight. It's always been tight, apart from a couple of years in the 80s, you know, in the mid 80s. It's always been that way. And you know, it's fine. I don't worry about it. I never worry about money because I find that if I worry, it gets worse. If I just trust that things will be okay, the universe provides for me. It just does. You know, just as long as I don't worry, that's the worst thing. If I panic about, you know, it. But something always comes up. And of course, I'm not daft. Like I seeded my book with... Like I wrote two plays, I wrote a film script with Jeff Young, And I've mentioned all this in the book just because at some point, some producer in America happens to see this thing and might get in touch and say, I'd really like to read that film script. I'd really like to, you know.
Yeah.
I do artwork as well, and I've done a couple of album sleeves for other people now, and I really enjoy that. I'm the world's worst. Seymour Stein said I was the worst frontman he'd ever seen, ever. And he'd seen like Tiny Tim in 1967, you know. And that's because he sort of was in the Welsh ones. And Paul, you played four songs with your back to the audience. You didn't introduce yourself. You didn't introduce the band. You didn't even tell people what the songs were called. But I've never felt comfortable. I wanted to be. I didn't really want to get into music. I fell into it, you know, at Eric's. I wanted to be an artist, really. So,
wow.
I'm crap at it. I'm really. Well,
I saw you Static. You did a gig at Static about.
Oh yeah.
Was that 10-15 years ago?
Yeah, they were the first ones we did. Did two nights. I was the first.
That was it. Yeah.
10 years or something. Oh, that was mad. It was theming gigs. Did a nautical one another time, but that one was the first one. That was meant to be like some sort of village hall jumble sale kind of thing from the 40s or 50s. But and I got all this bunting and shit up, but I don't know whether you'll remember, we had If, the Lindsay Anderson film, playing on stage.
Yeah.
I thought if I don't, because I had all this bunting up, all this Union Jack bunting, which was actually genuine wartime bunting. It had VE Day type slogans written on. Gone to so much trouble. You know, we just lost loads of money on it because we spent so much money dressing the venue. But a few people thought we were being like Empire fucking. And I was like, no.
Even worse now with the climate now. You'd have to be.
I don't think things, sometimes I just get enthusiastic and I don't think things through, you know. But it was a good band, that, though. We had Ricky from the Jonestown Massacre, Mike Mooney, Will Sargent, Les Pattinson.
That was a good night.
Yeah.
So when do you think you'll play your next live gig?
Your agent. I've been offered some interesting things actually by my agent, and but it's, you know what it's like. Even when you were 18, it was easy just to get your mates in a rehearsal room, but now everyone, you know. And then 20 years ago, everyone had young kids, but now everyone's got bad backs and. Hospital appointments, you know what I mean? It's quite a big deal. I'm a really crap sort of frontman, and so it's not like I can just strap on a guitar and go and do my own thing. I need a band, and if I'm going to do it, I want to do it properly. And
Courtney Love owes you, because you put her up, didn't you, when she was living in Liverpool? She owes you. I'm sure she could help.
I don't know. I'm not sure how happy she is with me, to be honest. But I don't know. I should. That would be the clever thing to do, get that new Welsh Ones album and go and do one of those sort of...
There's loads of great young musicians these days. And by young, I don't mean 20. I mean, you know, 30, 35, who are very, very good to work with. Because the way the music industry now is, there's no big record deals. So the musicians who aren't the writer... They're all brilliant because they have to diversify, so they're all doing all sorts of different things to make money as musicians, and it makes them really, really good players.
Okay.
So you'd be surprised how much easier it is, and because they all do their homework. There's none of that old Liverpool thing where they shoot themselves in the foot all of the time, or they think this is uncool or that's uncool. It's not like that anymore. The musicians are really hot and they're on it, you know, and they make it easier for you. So I think you know.
It's just the minute I know myself, the minute it feels like hard work, I'll bail. You know, I'm not thick-skinned enough. I don't know. You know, the last gig I played was in the Philippines, because we haven't talked about that. China crisis, I sort of met them in the street one day, and they just said, oh, you should get over to the Philippines, you're a superstar then. I honestly thought they were taking the piss. And it's true. So I went out in 2009, and I took the whole band with Les from the Bunnymen, all that out with me. And it was mad. I mean, that's Mick's read about it in the book. That's how the book starts. Because in fact, the opening lines of my book, you know, typical of my luck, the Wild Swans have landed in the Philippines during a Category 4 super typhoon. Chance of a lifetime to play monster gig, get properly paid. And it was the worst type. They have typhoons regularly out there, but it was the worst one they'd had for 40 years. And I'm like 26 floors up in a hotel room, and there's palm trees literally flying past the window, corrugated. Yeah, it was mad. Couldn't get to, we hadn't rehearsed for 3 months. We were going to rehearse when we got there. We'd need a submarine to get to the rehearsal studios. My name was on the contracts, loads of money at stake. It was a total nightmare. It came good in the end, but so I've been invited back.
That's your last gig then?
That was my last gig, yeah. Wow. Yeah, no, I very rarely. I mean, I'm not a musician. I pretend I am. If you ever look at my social media, all I ever post is stuff from the early 80s, mid 80s, you know.
There's our headline, Mick. Yeah.
There's the clip.
I've had a few reissues out and stuff, but you know, I don't exist. There's no Wild Swans section in the record shops anymore. I'm a ghost.
Well, what's the TV documentary that Graham McPhee is making, and you're part of that, aren't you?
Oh yeah. Hang on, don't undersell it. It might be a cinema documentary.
All right.
Yeah. It's in two parts now. It started off very small, and I was his first call. He came to me first, which blew my mind. I said, why are you talking to me and not Julian Cope or someone? And he said, because we know their stories. And he'd done one on the Scottish scene. And instead of talking to Edwin Collins or someone like that, they spoke to a sort of a peripheral kind of character called Davy Henderson from the Fire Engines. And it was great because of that, because we didn't know the stories, and he had a great angle on everything. He knew also Grant wanted me to be the Liverpool thing. And I said, well, what's it about? You know, what is it about? And so it's changed a few times. So originally, when he asked, could he call it Revolutionary Spirit, the film? I said, well, yeah, if it's going to be about Zoo Records, because we were at that time, we felt like it was us against the world. It wasn't really going to be about even Eric's, it was just about the Zoo Records. Well, then it broadened to become about Eric's, and they got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's gone back. He's gone right back to he went back to deaf school, and then he's gone back even earlier again to the sort of late 50s and stuff in Liverpool. So he split it into two films now. One's called A Pool of Life, and that's going to take in the Beat Poets and the Liverpool scene, the band, the Liverpool scene, all that weird kind of stuff that, you know, before we were on the scene. The second film, Revolutionary Spirit, is, I don't even know now what it's about. He's interviewed so many people, but it's got quite big. It's got it's got getting funding and stuff. So it could be a cinema thing. It might be a Netflix thing. But I'm in it a lot, really. But he filmed me at my maddest. I was my hair was down my, well, still getting along now, but it was down my back, and I was looking really feral in the filming. And because I was just about to leave Liverpool, you know, I think he filmed me literally locking the door of the house for the last time when I left Liverpool.
It's funny though, isn't it, that all this should come round when you probably sat around for years on end thinking,
yeah,
nobody's interested, and then all of this lovely stuff is happening to you.
Yeah,
life's wild, isn't it? You know,
yeah, it's magic. Life is magic. It really is. And so even despite me not. I'm not prolific. I don't do, you know, I don't give it loads, but people know about me anyway. My stock's gone up massively in the last 5 years, you know, to the point where people do know who I am. I was once voted best dressed man, right, by the Enemy. And the Enemy didn't know who Paul Simpson was. So they put Paul Simonon from The Clash instead. So he was the best dressed man. And he did look, he was quite a snappy dresser, but he won the award that I got voted for. Because he didn't know who I was, but like Mojo know who I am now. They've did a piece on me last year, and you know, I am actually doing proper press now. I got invited to do, you know, my book got 2 pages in The Guardian. 2 pages.
Yeah, I saw The Guardian review. It was
a feature, really, wasn't it? I got I got two center pages of the Herald up here, and you know, it's I've got a my own display in Waterstones in up here. You know, because I'm a local author. This is the great thing about moving. I'm a local author in three cities now.
Well, I tried to get a ticket for Waterstones in Liverpool at the end of Feb, and they sold out.
Yeah, it's probably because Will Sargent's hosting it for me. I'm probably going to see him. But, I was thinking about that because I'm going to do a reading probably, or a couple of readings. But I thought I might, you know, the books, the stories that didn't get go in the book.
Yeah,
I might do the one. I might read the stories from the second book at the Liverpool launch, just to make it a bit different to everywhere else. You know,
yeah,
Nico story. Oh my God! So I used to, because I used to suffer from depression. Rather than talking about it with anyone, because I didn't feel like I could, I just used to buy. Remember the Transalpino? Transalpino used to have an office in town, and you could just go in, give them 26 quid, and you get a 3 cities in Europe ticket, a rail pass, any or ferries, anything for 26 quid. It was brilliant. So I used to take up myself off to Amsterdam all the time for a week and just doss on people's floors and things. Anyway, I went off to Amsterdam for a fortnight to try and lose this depression. And so I got into Amsterdam Central at 6 a.m. So I couldn't check into my hostel or anything. So I just went for a walk in the park. And then I got some coffee and I was walking through the street and I saw this bloke walking towards me, looked familiar. He goes, "All right, Paul Simpson, isn't it? All right." And it's Alan Wise, you know, who's part of this sort of Manchester kind of scene. And he goes, "What are you doing? Have you had your breakfast yet?" And I went, "No, I haven't." He went, "Oh, come with me." So I thought we were going to a cafe. So he takes me up this staircase, walk into this room, and he goes, Nina, got a wave and stray here. Can you make him some breakfast?" And it's Nico from the Velvet Underground. Because she's playing at the Paradiso that night. Alan's her manager. And then he fucks off and leaves me with her. 2 hours. So Nico of the Velvet, I've just arrived in Amsterdam. Edinburgh's with depression. Nico's making me breakfast. And this is mad. I thought she was an old woman at the time. Because she had this big old sort of cardigan on, and she was gorgeous, she was lovely, you know. Paul, you're so thin. Let me make you something. Would you like some herbal tea? I've got the yogurt here. Let me know. You need something more substantial. Eggs, do you need? You know, and
did you go to the gig?
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's a great place.
Yeah. Gregory Corso, the beat poet, was on first, and he caused a riot, literally a riot. It was mega. But who does that? How many people does that happen to, you know? And I thought she was an old woman. I've done, when I was writing the book, I did some research. She was 42.
Right.
She was 42 at the time. And I don't mean she'd aged badly. She hadn't. It was just I was young, you know.
Well, the final track has got an intro of 3.5 minutes.
What, is this the Wipers?
Yeah. But the words come in after 3.5 minutes, don't they, Paul?
Well, this is, I didn't know about this at the time because this is 1982, this track. And I didn't hear it till about 1990, but oh my God. I think this might be the most exciting track I've ever heard. You know, just for sheer adrenaline, it's beautiful.
Well, I'd love to have heard it live because it builds up that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's the Wipers and When It's Over.
be over.
I loved every moment of that.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Appreciate it. Thanks so much for asking me, guys. Historically, people don't ask me to do these things, you know.
I'm loving that it's you're getting all attention from people, and they've it's come back round to you.
Yeah, I need to start channeling into some being a bit more productive, really, don't I? Start doing some gigs and actually.
We're playing at the doing a gig at the Hug and Pint on the
20th. Oh, it's nice, yeah, it's good venue
on
yeah.
Saturday. So if you want to come along, I'll
is Saturday coming?
I don't know, but we're playing on the 24th of February. It's a Saturday night in Glasgow.
Okay, so 24th.
If you want to come along, I'll sort that out for you.
Lovely. Okay. If I'm here, I might be in Dublin then.
Okay. I'll email you.
Yeah. All right. But thank you so much.
Yeah. And yeah, that'll be fun. I've never been there. What's it like, by the way?
It's good. It's a sort of basement gig, and they're always the best ones, I think.
Yeah.
Small, but kind of. I saw a Canadian band in there called Tallies last year, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's good. You know, Glasgow audiences are great, so
yeah. I'm going, I think a couple of weeks after that, I'm playing with Damien Dempsey. Have you ever heard of Damo?
Yeah.
I'm up there with him as well. Cool. I say you're in the middle of it there now, aren't you? With Glasgow, but then you've got to go off to Dublin. Where would it be after that? New York,
yeah. Oh, that'd be good, nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, maybe
doing all the Irish cities.
Yeah.
Many thanks, Paul. That was really interesting and entertaining, just as much as the book is as well, you know.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
And good luck with the book signing and any other projects you've got.
Brilliant. And,
I'm sure me and Ian both think that it'd be great to see you on stage at some time or record something, you know. It'd be lovely. I know it may happen, it may not happen, but whatever you decide, I'm sure it'll be the right one for you.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it.
Lots nice of one, mate.
Thanks a lot.
Great. All right, guys.
Nice one, pal.
See ya. See you.